Strategic Christian Services is pleased to present Worldview, part of the Strategic Beginning Series. This is Session 5, entitled Measuring Worldview, with Adam Peacock.
Welcome to another lesson in the Strategic Beginning Series. It's a pleasure to be sharing with you. And the title of this particular lesson is Measuring Worldview. What we're going to be looking at is how do you judge whether the worldview you subscribe to or a worldview that another subscribes to is worthy of holding your beliefs or their beliefs. We're really looking at the worldview themselves, the systems of thoughts, the systems of beliefs and the proofs and those sorts of things that come out of those heart beliefs, whether they are worthy of someone's life, really, their actions and their trust in terms of putting their lives on those beliefs. Before we jump into the lesson, though, I would like to ask you to turn with me. We're going to look in the Gospel of Luke in the 14th chapter, and I'd like to read verses 25 through 35. It says in verse 25, "Now great multitudes were going along with him," that's Jesus, "and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks terms of peace. So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his possessions. Therefore, salt is good, but if even salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It is useless either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." I'm sure that Jesus' last statement there, "he who has ears to hear, let him hear," echoes throughout history. Each time as we read this section of Scripture, we've got to ask God, do I have the ears to hear what you're really after? And I believe that all of us should ask that question even as we're beginning this process of worldview. Do I really have ears to hear what you're saying, Jesus? You know, it says in Deuteronomy chapter 6 that we're to love the Lord our God with all of our mind. That's one of the things that it points out. And developing a integrated and an influencing worldview is part of that process, I believe, of loving God with all of our mind. It's part of that process of discipleship, of bringing all things under Christ. And when we're talking about giving up all of our possessions, I believe that it really transcends just our material things, but also relational things, as is pointed out with the family relationships that Jesus points out, our time, really everything that we interact with, everything that we would consider ours must be Jesus's if we're truly going to be disciples. And in this passage, he's challenging us to count the cost, to realize that we have to be able to give everything or else we might want to rethink whether we get started at all. And as we have begun this process of developing a biblical Christian worldview, I just want to encourage you again at the outset that this is not an easy process. It's not a process without pain. If you're really going to pursue this to the ends that I believe that you need to, it's not just going through an introductory series that's going to be enough, but you're really going to have to wrestle with maybe difficult questions and really wrestle with them till you find an answer that applies to your life. You should do other research and other study in the field of worldview. Don't just rely on this one series. Read some books that are available on worldview. Go to some conferences that are dealing with worldview. Consider doing the School of Christian Worldview and Strategic Life Training. Do something that's going to follow up. Follow this thing through. See it to the end. And that process, it takes time. It takes energy. You know, as you're doing further study, you're going to find that as you get further into it, there's a new vocabulary that you're going to have to deal with. You're going to be using words that are not easy necessarily to understand right off of the bat. You're going to be dealing with new concepts. You're going to be wrestling with application and with implications. If I believe this, what does that imply about what I should do in this particular situation? You're going to find yourself having to check if you're really consistent. Does my life and my opinion really reflect what I believe? Am I looking through a blue lens, but when I'm hanging out with my friends talking like I'm looking through a red lens? All of those types of things are going to be challenges and are going to be, at some points, probably very painful in this process. But I want to encourage you, though it may seem easier, to remain someone who's influenced. Though it may seem more comfortable to stay as someone who's integrated in your journey, I want to encourage you to press on through the fullness of this process. I believe that you will do that. I believe that having been exposed to this information, that there is that desire in you then to take it to its completion. I don't believe once you've been exposed to the truth, really been exposed to the truth of God, that you can ever be satisfied settling for less. And I want to challenge you, as you've been exposed to even little bits of the truth of God, not to be satisfied with less than really pursuing and discovering more fully the truths of God as He's revealed them in His world, in His Word, and into our lives in so many different ways. And so that's my encouragement to you. And again, as you're on this journey of worldview, as you're on this path of coming to a place where you know what you believe and why you believe it, set yourself for the long haul. Set yourself knowing that this is going to be a journey that you will be involved in for years and years and years, and really for the rest of your life and probably into the next life, as God continues to shape us into the image of His Son and continues to bring us forth into all that He created us to be. That having been said, as you begin in this process and become more comfortable with thinking from a worldview point of view, more comfortable with the concepts and practicing and applying some of the principles that we're talking about to your thinking into your life, judging yourself in terms of where you are in the journey, you're going to become more conscious of where you're at. You're going to become more conscious of the things that you say and whether they really line up with what you believe. And you're also going to become more conscious of the worldview of others around you. You'll also become more conscious of the things that others say. Maybe if you're listening to songs on the radio or hearing music as you're out in public and you hear the lyrics, you'll be more conscious of what the worldview is behind the lyrics. You'll probably be more conscious of the content of conversation of your friends or the content of what you might see on television or in the movies. Suddenly, you're going to be ruined, as it were, to some of the things that maybe you were okay with before. Ruined in that you won't be able to hear them in the same way. Ruined that you won't be able to judge them in the same way. You won't be able to think the same as you used to think, because you've become conscious of what you believe and why you believe it. You've become less susceptible to being influenced. You've become more aware of where others are trying to influence you or influence those around them. And it's an eye-opening process. It's going to be encouraging. The more you see it, the more you'll recognize that things are really changing in your life. And I want to encourage you to really look for those things, because it will be an encouragement for you, and it will be a reflection for you of how you're progressing on this journey. What I'd like to do for the majority of this lesson is really look at how we measure an integrated worldview. Now, we talked about our journey and us coming to a place where we are integrated within our worldview. That is that we know what we believe and why we believe it. That is that we are consistent with our beliefs, that we are connected. That is, all aspects of our worldview are connected and really fit into one piece. And we talked about judging ourselves along that standard. And we want to turn this a little bit and focus outward towards the worldview itself and talk about what a worldview that's capable of being integrated looks like. And so we're going to look at three particular measurements of worldviews, and this will allow you not only to challenge yourself in terms of the things that you've subscribed to, but more specifically, to be able to recognize gaps in other worldviews and help others see where their gaps would be. The first measurement that we want to look at is this: an integrated worldview must handle all of the data. It must handle all of the data. What do we mean by that? It means that there must be a big enough scope of the worldview that nothing in all of reality and all of history and all of experience, that nothing falls outside of that, that that worldview can address everything that could possibly happen. If a worldview does not handle all the data, it is not integrated because it's not big enough. If there's something outside of it, then suddenly there's two perspectives, there's two categories. And so it has to be something that everything else can fit within and be integrated with. And this is quite a big criterion for a worldview. There's a neat biblical example of this that you can see in Acts chapter 28. We'd be looking at verses 1 through 10. And if you look through, it's a story of Paul. He's shipwrecked on his way to Rome, and they get washed ashore on the island of Malta. And as they're, you know, taking care of their situation, it looks like they're building a fire. And as he's grabbing some of the firewood, just, you know, being a serving in a regular capacity, he's bitten by a poisonous snake. And it's the type of poison that would kill someone very quickly. And apparently is a type of snake that those on the island of Malta, the island people there, are familiar with. And when Paul is unaffected by the poison, when he continues to function fine, talk fine, he doesn't fall over and die, they realize that there's something that's taken place that transcended their worldview, that their worldview did not actually handle all the data. And it brings them to a place where, first of all, they worship Paul, but it also brings them to a place then where Paul, sensing this, is able to present the gospel to them and introduce them to a worldview that does handle all the data. And that really is my next point in regards to the biblical Christian worldview, is that the biblical Christian worldview is a worldview that handles all of the data. And the Bible, in principle, addresses every part of life that we ever will face, that we ever have faced, that anyone ever has faced. The Bible, as God's revealed word, again, in principle, addresses all areas. It addresses everything. And that is a huge, because when we're talking about everything, we're not just talking about the philosophical questions, but we're talking about the practical applications. You know, what do we believe about the environment? What do we believe about work and rest? What do we believe about family and disciplining children? What do we believe about the criminal justice system? What do we believe about music and what makes good music versus bad music? What do we believe about agriculture? You can go on and on. Every aspect of life is covered in the scriptures. But a lot of times it's most difficult when we're talking about worldview handling all the data, as individuals at least, dealing with, does it handle all of the data from a philosophical point of view? Because that, again, many times brings us back to those faith choices, those heart beliefs. And from that place of a faith choice, a heart belief, can we show that the heart belief, the thing that we've put our faith in, actually handles all the data from that philosophical point of view? And this is where a worldview can sometimes become intellectually challenging. Again, I mentioned that as you develop in worldview, you're going to be dealing with some new concepts and some new words. And I just want to give a list of some important questions, and you may have heard some of these, but some important questions that must be addressed if a worldview is going to handle all of the data. And this by no means is all of the questions, but they are some important ones. The first is basically, what is real? That is, what is the nature of reality? And there's several different ways to ask this question. One of the ones that was most profound to me, or at least most amusing to me, it was asked this way by Jean-Paul Sartre, which was, why is there anything rather than nothing at all? Why is there anything rather than nothing at all? In that question resides all sorts of questions. The question of, is there a God or not? But not just, is there a God or not, but what is he like? And if he has a creative bent, why did he create the earth? And why did he create it the way that he did? And on and on and on. Those are big questions to be able to wrestle with and be able to ask. Under that, then you would ask the question, how did we get here? Again, now that we've established that there is something, it's pretty difficult to believe that there is nothing at all. It's not really philosophically a very safe place to stand, because as Descartes pointed out, the very act that we're thinking and asking the question shows the existence of something. However, the question then can be, how did we get here? Evolution or creation? And all the variations of evolution and those sorts of things. Where are we going? Philosophically, this is a question of where's history going? And there's a terminology for it called teleology. It's dealing with that question of where are we going? Where is history going? Where is all of this headed? For us as Christians, it's the understanding of God being glorified and the Father and the Son and the culmination of the Father giving all authority to Christ in such a tangible, practical way, and then the Son offering those things back up to the Father in that relationship to them. The culmination of history and the second coming of Christ and the judgment, all of those things as a Christian are dealt with through the Bible. How about this? What is of ultimate value? This question in philosophy is dealt with within the field of axiology. And basically, it deals with what's of ultimate value. And this is very important in the study of ethics and morals and those sorts of things. From a biblical standpoint, God is of ultimate value. And it's his purposes and his desires that are most important. And everything else is valued in relationship to God, valued in relationship to what he thinks about it, valued in relationship to what he says about it. And so as biblical Christians, that's how we determine what is of ultimate value. How about this question? How do we know what is true? Or another way that I've heard it asked is, how do we know, and how do we know that we know? And if you can wrap your mind around that, it's basically a question of when we assert something is real, when we assert something is true, by what standard are we measuring it? What is the standard or the method of doing that? And in our world, there's all sorts of different standards that people look to. Personal experience, of course, in the younger generation is maybe the most prevalent standard by which people know something is real or not to them. And you'll often hear the statement, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. That may be real in your life, but it's not real in my life because I haven't experienced it. Now, obviously, that type of a statement is a suicide from the context of an integrated worldview, because it's basically saying that my worldview will not handle all the data. It will only handle everything that I've experienced. And it's not integrated in that way. And we might talk a little bit more about that later. But as a biblical Christian, how we know and how we know that we know, it's a philosophical question of epistemology. And again, these words aren't as important right now, but they will be important as we get further into the worldview process. So please don't be intimidated by them, but definitely be curious by them, because they really do just represent ideas and concepts that I know everyone who's listening would be able to understand if we apply some energy to it. As biblical Christians, when we're answering that question of how do we know and how do we know that we know, ultimately we come to the perspective that it is revelation from God, as opposed to our reason, as opposed to science, as opposed to personal experience. It is revelation from God that is our highest standard of verifying truth. And then we also believe that specifically the Bible is the revealed word of God. It's not the whole of what God has said. He has also spoken through his creation, as Paul says in Romans 1, and he speaks in other ways. But it is, the Bible is a comprehensive and specific picture of the revelation from God to us that allows us to have a worldview that is capable of addressing all of the data. Other questions? What is the nature of man? This question is a very important one from a philosophical point of view and from a worldview point of view. Everyone must answer this question with their worldview, and a worldview must handle that data. How do we change? Most anyone that you would talk to would recognize that there are significant problems in the world that we live in. And a lot of those problems are not just situational problems, so people might attribute the cause to situations, but they're complicated interpersonal problems and personal problems. The question is, how do we change? What is it that brings those fundamental changes in people's lives? How do we experience transformation? That is an incredible question and a very relevant question, really, for every worldview that's going to handle all the data. How are we going to take things from a current condition to a better condition? As biblical Christians, we believe that the initiation of all change is God, and it's by His revelation and by His revealed work and by His word that change begins. Now, that process, that being faithful to complete the things that He begun, as it were in Philippians chapter 1, where it talks about that, that's something that is manifest and worked out in several different ways. But the root of it, the beginning of how people change, is through revelation from God. And it's out of that revelation then that we work out, based on the individual and the situation, the actual relevancy of that change and it being made clear. So those are some major questions. What happens when we die is another one that every worldview must address. What happens when we die? If a worldview does not handle all the data, if it cannot handle all of those type of questions, and again, right down into all the specifics about recycling and what type of cleaning products we should or shouldn't use, worldview should be capable of addressing all of those things, then it's not big enough. If it can't do that, it's not big enough, and it's not really a worthy worldview. It's not capable of being integrated in that way. So that is the first measurement, that it's able to handle all of the data, all of the things that are revealed and expressed in history, both from an idea standpoint as well as an experience standpoint or an event standpoint. Okay, the second measurement for an integrated worldview is it consistent with itself? Is it consistent with itself? Now, from a rational point of view, in terms of dealing with the laws of reason and logic and those sorts of things, this should be a no-brainer. However, we're not living in a world that culturally is as grounded in rational thinking and in kind of modern thought, as it were. We live in a postmodern world, that is, an after-modern thinking world. And postmodern thinking is not so concerned with logic and whether everything fits right exactly in its place. An example of that is the relativist worldview or point of view. And the relativists, one of the things that you might hear them say is, there are no absolutes, or there is no one truth. Now, in those types of statements, they are interesting statements in themselves. Let's look in particular at there are no absolutes. Now, as that said, really what's being said is there are absolutely no absolutes. Now, do you see the contradiction in that statement? There are absolutely no absolutes. The statement that there are no absolutes is an absolute statement and thus totally contradicts the whole philosophy that's just being said, the whole point of view that's just being said. That worldview, even at its very foundation, is inconsistent with itself. The thing about a worldview that's inconsistent with itself is that it is not capable of being integrated. It's not that there's not a lot of data that it can handle, or maybe that it can handle all of the data, but it just can't piece it all together. And when it's incapable of being integrated, then it's fully vulnerable to influence. And that's the thing with those who hold worldviews that are not consistent with themselves, is that they are very, very capable of being influenced. They can't, until they have been intercepted, they've gone through that process of being intercepted and have grabbed a hold of a worldview that actually does handle all the data and is consistent with itself, they really are unable to protect themselves from being influenced. And that is the case with those who subscribe to a relativist worldview or point of view. They are very influenced. They are very much products of the culture around them because of the fact that the worldview that they subscribe to is not consistent with itself. And so they have to take on perspectives and are influenced from other sources. I've got a great personal story that's an example of this, where I was able to challenge someone who was in this type of perspective. His worldview was inconsistent with itself, and hopefully sow some seeds for God to challenge him with the gospel message. I was flying back from Seattle. I was actually on the way to the birth of my nephew. My sister was in labor, and I was on an airplane. I went standby, and I ended up getting a middle seat in order to get on the plane, and sitting to my left was a young man, not too much older than me, about my same age, dressed nicely. You could tell that he was a business professional, and he wanted to talk, which I guess was okay with me. I definitely welcome the opportunities that God gives me, but in all honesty, I'm almost 6'6" and not very comfortable flying coach most often, and so I try and sleep a lot when I'm on the plane, so I wasn't just going out of my way to interact with him, but he was excited about talking, and in the conversation, in the midst of the conversation, he asked me the question of, what do I do for a living? So I told him that I was a minister, and there's other ways that I can describe what I do, but I like describing it in that fashion and seeing people's reactions. And his reaction was very positive. He said, "Oh, that's great. Let me tell you the type of church that you should pastor, because I believe that it's the type of church that I would go to and that many other people would go to." And he said, "It would be a church where you could believe pretty much anything you wanted, you could do anything you wanted, you'd receive unconditional love and encouragement and understanding, those types of things." That's the gist of what he said. And I listened to him and processed what he said. And I came back and said to him this. I said, "You know, I am sure, I'm not surprised that you would think that a lot of people would come to that sort of a church. And I can see that that would be a very popular type of church, but I could never pastor that particular type of church." I said, "This is the reason. It's because a whole aspect of ministry is to help people to grow and to mature and to be able to experience transformation in their lives. And the type of church that you've described would not challenge people to be changed, would not challenge people to be transformed." I said, "And furthermore, I believe that you and I have a basic difference in our faith beliefs and our assumptions about the nature of man. See, I believe that man is basically fallen and that he needs God to do a work in his heart that will change his heart. So instead of being bent on doing the evil thing and the rebellious thing, he has not only a desire but an ability, because of what God does by empowering him in his life, the ability to actually do good and to obey God." And man, it was bingo, nail hit right on the head. He said, "Absolutely, that's true. I don't believe that man is basically fallen. I believe that man is basically good." And again, one of the reasons why I was able to do well in conversations with Joey, who we talked about earlier, others like him, is because when it comes to debating issues, I definitely need and try to provide helpful examples and evidences of what I believe concerning the issue that's being discussed, but always by desiring to position someone for God to reveal something in their heart to bring conviction there, I'm always after going right down to the belief level. And in doing that, in going down to the belief level, you get beyond some of the other pitfalls that you can get hung up in when you're dealing with apologetics or other types of defenses of the faith, and you're able to really go after people's heart or faith beliefs. And so he was open very early in our conversation to dealing at this level because being able to pinpoint that distinction in our two perspectives of the nature of people and what they're like. And so without getting too far into our discussion, we debated for quite some time as to the basic nature of man and why people do bad things and all those implications that surround that. And towards the end of our conversation, one of the things that really allowed me to make an impact in his thinking and allowed me to challenge him with the truth of the gospel was the fact that he was inconsistent in his worldview. I think just based on some of the things that came up in our conversation that I observed about him, that one of the reasons why he even wanted to talk with me about church and wanted to describe the type of church he would go to is that there was a desire in him to feel like he had gotten right with God. Now, granted, he wanted to do that in his own fashion and in his own way without really submitting to God, but there was that sense of guilt and other things that made him desire for some type of relationship with God. Question again is on whose terms? And he was unwilling to believe that he was himself fallen. He wanted to believe that he was basically good and it was circumstances around him that had forced him to make bad decisions or those sorts of things. So he had that belief in the basic goodness of man, but at the same time, he had been raised with a Catholic background and truly believed that there was something special about Jesus and really subscribed to the concept that Jesus was sent by God as a Savior. And therein lies the contradiction, the inconsistency in his worldview that I was able to challenge him on. I said, if man is basically good, then why did God need to send a Savior? If man is basically good, why did Jesus need to be sent to die on the cross? I mean, why would God send his only begotten, his beloved Son, to die if it was really just an environmental problem? And as that inconsistency was shown to him in his worldview, suddenly he was open to the gospel in a way that he hadn't been open before, because his defenses at that faith belief level had been broken down and his heart was open to the truth of the word. So it's a great reminder for me personally, and maybe helpful for you when we're talking about the need for consistency, is a worldview must be consistent with itself. And in that particular situation, it wasn't. And so he was able to be influenced by me towards an understanding of the gospel. And I pray that while we didn't pray together in regards to him accepting Christ, I pray that that was a seed that someone else will water and someone else will reap. Okay, third measurement of an integrated worldview is that it satisfies the deepest longings of a person's heart, and even more specifically, satisfies the deepest longings of your heart. Let's start with you. This is one that obviously transcends just the philosophical understanding level and really gets down to the heart level of, is it livable? Is it really livable, and does it bring life and fulfillment? Yes, it handles all the data from a technical standpoint. Yes, it's technically consistent, but is it something that you can find life in? And this is a very important measurement. I would encourage you, as you get into worldview, don't just study the biblical Christian worldview, but study other worldviews to some level. Again, as you mature, you'll be able to handle recognizing the different beliefs without getting sidetracked or without getting swayed or improperly influenced. Obviously, you're going to be able to do a much better job of evaluating other worldviews when you're fully integrated within your own worldview. But as you learn what you believe and why you believe it, you'll also begin to identify in other worldviews what you don't believe and why you don't believe it. And as you're studying other worldviews, I'd encourage you not only to look at whether those worldviews handle all the data, whether or not they're consistent with themselves, but also look at the lives of those who advanced the particular thought processes and grids and basic assumptions and ideas of the worldviews we're talking about. For example, Marxism is a worldview. There's a whole ideology around it, and there's other aspects where the Marxist ideology ties into other ideologies to make the worldview. For example, true Marxism is materialistic in nature, in that it subscribes to the fact that there really is only matter. But look at the life of Karl Marx. As you're studying the Marxist philosophy, the Marxist perspective, look at the life of Karl Marx and see if this person who developed these ideas, this person who espoused these ideas, one, was he able to live those ideas himself? If he wasn't, you've got to ask the question why. Secondly, to the degree that he did live out those ideas, from what you can see, was he fulfilled? Did he die happy? That's a very important question. I mean, you can look at Nietzsche and Freud and others. Look at their lives and see if they were able to actually live the things that they subscribed to, and if they died happy and were happy to the degree that they tried to live out those beliefs. And that's a huge thing. I think of, you know, things that every human heart, I believe, because the way that God's fashioned them, looks for. Every human heart wants to be loved. You know, is the worldview consistent with itself? You know, is a question of philosophical level. But what about simply, is it satisfying? Is there a place for love within that worldview? I look at the evolutionary equation, and we talk about the first standard and being able to handle all of the data. Well, the evolutionary equation, and in a general context, is that matter and energy plus time and chance equals everything that is. That's basically the equation. And that equal sign means that everything on one side of the equation is equal to everything on the other. So when we talk about all that is, it's got to be what's before the equal side, or on the other side of everything that is now, is that everything that is now came from and can be traced back to matter, energy, time, and chance. And one of the things that the evolutionary equation does a poor job of handling are things that deal with personality and personhood and love and those types of aspects that most people subscribe to as being real but are not contained within the evolutionary perspective and the evolutionary explanation of how we got here. Thus, the materialistic worldview is not able to handle all of the data. But even more than not being able to handle all of the data, it's not able to satisfy that longing in people's hearts for love. The existentialist worldview, it's not able to, from a philosophical point of view, satisfy the longing in individuals' hearts to belong. There's something I believe that God's put in every individual's heart to belong. Even many times acts of rebellion are statements of a desire to belong as much as they are a disdain of the group. And there is something I believe in each one of us that wants to belong to something, to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. And there's other things like forgiveness. I believe that every heart knows that it is sinned and that it is estranged from God. Now, how they process that, how each heart processes that and each person processes that is very different. But there's that need for forgiveness, that desire for forgiveness. I know in the New Age movement, there's tons of different ways that people go to try and wash away that basic guilt that they have and try and find ways other than Christ to fulfill that basic need for forgiveness. And there's so many different approaches to that. I think about when I was at UCLA my senior year, I lived in a house, and in the house next door to me lived a witch. I mean, full-fledged witch. She would have seances and all sorts of things over at her house. She was helping others through it. She had all sorts of idols and all sorts of things going on. You could see through her window, and I mean, she was blatant with it. And I talked with her on a couple of occasions, and in talking with her and even just looking at her, I could see that she was not a witch based out of a desire for, you know, power or some of the other reasons why someone might be involved in it. She was a witch and was pursuing these things based on a deep fear in her. There was a deep fear in her, and so it encouraged her, and she, out of that fear, she embraced these things that she thought were going to help protect her, that were going to help bring security to her and help her get beyond her fears. And in seeing that, I was just struck again by the fact that while she went after all these things, her fears never changed. While she was subscribing to this worldview and finding all these, you know, mystical and wild and wonderful ways of trying to explain all the data and keep things consistent, at the elemental, fundamental level, it was not satisfying the deepest longing of her heart, and it was not bringing the security that a true worldview that's integrated can bring. And so those three measurements are three main measurements for an integrated worldview and should help us not only measure our own worldview and give us confidence in the quality as it were, on the marketplace of worldviews, the surpassing quality of the biblical worldview, but also allow us then to recognize gaps in others' worldviews. And again, when we're talking about being on the worldview journey, as we begin to see opportunities to be a positive influence on others, that you can recognize where their thinking has these gaps and begin to use those as opportunities to hopefully position them for God to reach into their heart and grab a hold of their perspective. Really, again, keep these things in mind as you are in conversation with others, as you are discovering and in this whole discovery process of worldview, because they should be able to really help you pinpoint the things that you should go after. And as we're closing, I really want to go back to my conversation with the man on the airplane. I mentioned that because his worldview was not consistent with itself, he was in a position to be influenced. And those who are in that place of the journey where they are influenced, or they are even intercepted but still in that place of not being integrated, so they're intercepted but still receiving influences from others, you'll see in those people that they really are products of the world around them and of the culture around them. And I believe that God has not called us to be products of the world's culture, but he's called us to be prophetic voices, or another perspective would be a way of saying it. He's called us to be a godly perspective and a witness to them, a prophetic voice to them of his culture and of his truth and of the reality that he has created for us to walk in and to live in. And it's kind of an easy way to remember it, of don't be a product of your culture, be a prophetic voice to it. And I want to encourage you to go from that place on the journey where maybe you've been influenced to where you can be an influencer. And I'd like to challenge you to look at your own life and the things that you do, even the clothes that you wear and those practical decisions that you make, and ask yourself, am I a product? Am I revealing the fact that I'm a product of the culture around me? Or am I a prophetic voice? Am I a godly perspective? Am I another point of view to the culture around me that's pointing them to God, pointing them to the truth that he's revealed in his word? And as we close, I really want to challenge you to do that. And challenge your believing friends where you see that they're representing views that show that they've been influenced, that show them as having views where they're products of the culture around them. Challenge them with what the Bible says about those things. Challenge them with the biblical worldview. I trust that this has been helpful for you. I want to encourage you as you're continuing down this journey and as you're desiring to become integrated in your worldview and able to influence and help others and come to a godly perspective. I want to challenge you that you use all the truth and all of the tools that you're being given in a way that reflects and honors God, and in a way that has another's best interests in mind versus your own. As you get truth and knowledge, the Bible says that knowledge puffs up. It can puff up. If you don't receive things, if you don't receive wisdom with a humble heart, if it's mixed with arrogance and those sorts of things, then you'll be able to use these things to beat people over the head with and to hurt them and to walk over them for the sake of elevating yourself. And I want to challenge you, don't do it. Do not do that, but keep your heart right before God. Keep your motives right before God. And don't use these tools and don't use these truths that you're getting as some sort of a badge to go around and show how smart you are and how much you know and those sorts of things. But hold them with a humble heart. Process these things against yourself first. And where you have an opportunity to make an impact in someone's life, make that impact a positive one. Make that impact a godly one. Position them. Have their best interests in mind as you relate to them. Desire to position them for relationship with God, for growth and maturing in the Lord. That should be your desire. And that's my exhortation even now, as you are now more capable of judging others' worldviews, that you make that judgment in a godly context and from a godly perspective. The Lord bless you.
This is a copyrighted program of Strategic Christian Services, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Strategic Christian Services offers a wide variety of other educational materials and training schools designed to help you live life to its fullest. For more information on our products and services, please call us at 1-800-700-0605. Join us online at www.gostrategic.org or write to us at Post Office Box 2709, Santa Rosa, California 95405.